Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday. The Supreme Court on Monday of this week agreed to hear a challenge to the health care overhaul bill that the president signed into legislation. It sets the stage for oral arguments that will happen in March and a decision in June. And this, of course, is as the 2012 presidential campaign is entering its crucial final months. This hour of the program, we'll talk about the range of issues the court agreed to address, why it is that 26 states are challenging the law and the federal government, and also the dynamics of all of this, the personalities on the Supreme Court, and how all of this is going to create just a whole lot of attention. And of course, the big question is whether or not there is a likelihood that the health care law or parts of it could be overturned. Joining us this hour is Dahlia Lithwick, a senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate, who writes the column Supreme Court Dispatches and has covered a number of issues, the Microsoft trial and other legal issues. She worked for a family law firm in Reno, Nevada, and clerked for Proctor Hugg, Chief Justice of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in 1996. She's written for the New Republic, Commentary, the New York Times, Washington Post, CNN, and is a weekly legal commentator for the NPR show Day to Day. She's an author of Me Versus Everybody, Absurd Contracts for an Absurd World. She is a graduate of Yale University, where she did her undergraduate work and received her law degree from Stanford Law School. Our phone number for you to join the conversation, I'm sure we'll have quite a few calls this hour, is 800-486-8655, and our email address is talk@wpr.org. Dahlia, good morning. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me, Kathleen.
So tell me, why did the Supreme Court decide to take this up during this crucial presidential election year? It's going to be a front and center issue now.
I really don't think they had an option. What the court looks for when they agree to take a case, and, you know, remember, they only hear 70-some cases a year, so they say no to almost everything that comes up.
Mm-hmm.
They have to take a case where you have a major piece of legislation and you have federal appeals courts all around the country coming to irreconcilable conclusions. So in this case, we had four federal appeals courts had weighed in on the constitutionality of this thing. Two had said it's constitutional, one had struck it down, and one had said we don't have jurisdiction to hear it. At that point, there is such chaos in the system. You know, states don't know what they're supposed to do. In some states, it's constitutional and some it isn't. Really, the court had no alternative under these circumstances but to take it. And trust me, I don't think the court wanted to be front and center in an election year all that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would imagine they didn't. And those courts were striking down the whole law, or were they looking at parts of the law?
No court struck down the whole law. There was one federal district court, so one trial court, who heard the case. Now, this is the big case that the court actually agreed to hear that comes up. That's 26 state attorneys general filed a suit. And in that case, the trial court said, you know what, the whole law is unconstitutional, not just the individual mandate provision, which we'll talk about. But because that falls, the whole law falls. The appeals court disagreed. The appeals court said, no, in fact, you can strike down the mandate, which they did, but the rest of the law survives. And that's one of the four issues the court is going to grapple with this spring, is this question of severability. Can you strike down a chunk of the law, or does the whole thing have to fall?
Mm-hmm. And tell me about those state attorneys general, 26 of them. That's quite a few. Are all the states united in what their particular gripe is?
Well, there were other states. For instance, Virginia filed a suit. Ken Cuccinelli, who's the attorney general for the Commonwealth of Virginia, didn't join that suit. He went ahead and filed a different suit that was litigated at the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeal, where he, in fact, lost. So it wasn't that every single attorney general jumped onto that suit, although certainly most of them did. But the bulk of the complaints, whether they're in that 11th Circuit decision or the one that came up through the 4th Circuit, are the same. It's the central issue we've been debating, you know, pretty much for a year and a half now, which is this individual mandate question, the question of whether the government can compel you to purchase health insurance.
Mm-hmm. And what are they looking at constitutionally that would lead them to believe that the government cannot require that?
Well, it comes down to a pretty in-the-weeds conversation about Congress's Commerce Clause power. In the Constitution, Congress is given the power to regulate matters of interstate commerce. And at least since 1942, in a very, very seminal case called Wickard versus Filburn, the position the courts have taken is even something as insignificant as a farmer in that case growing wheat for his own use and his own family's use can be regulated by Congress as interstate commerce because it affects interstate economies. So this is a principle that's rightly or wrongly been written into the law for close to 100 years, and now the question is the court going to reexamine the idea that interstate commerce is implicated by the decision to force somebody, as they would say, I think, to force somebody to purchase health insurance against their will. Is this something that implicates interstate commerce? Is really the guts of the dispute here.
Mm-hmm. Aren't there a lot of other things that maybe they relate to that Commerce Clause and maybe not, that a lot of people would do that's against their will?
Well, I think there is a feeling, and this is the way the argument was framed from the beginning by the opponents of the law, and it was a very, very smart framing, is to say that Congress has never before regulated what's called, quote, inactivity, that Congress has all sorts of power to do all sorts of things, including the growing of wheat, but they have never said you have to purchase something if the alternative is that you do nothing. And that's been the really original argument in this case. And I think it's been a surprising argument, but it has gained enormous traction, not just in the courts. The courts who have struck this down have been very impressed by the idea that commerce cannot force you, who would otherwise not do something, to do something. That's really different.
Oh, my. I want you to say that again, please. Congress can what?
That the argument is that if the Congress can, that it's certainly fine for Congress to regulate activity. If you choose to drive, Congress can force you to get a license.
Okay.
If you choose to send your kids to school, Congress can force you to do certain things. But the argument is, in this case, the decision to not purchase health insurance is defined as inactivity. It's as doing nothing, and that they cannot force you, if you choose to do nothing, to purchase something. That's the argument. And the extension of that argument, and here is where I think the Obama administration has really gotten into trouble in attempting to defend the law, that if Congress can force people who are just passively living their lives, not buying health insurance, if Congress can force them to buy health insurance, then what's to stop Congress from, say it with me now, forcing people to eat broccoli, forcing people to buy General Motors cars in order to prop up the auto industry? And believe it or not, even though that seems like a stretch, it's a sort of a slippery slope argument, at oral argument throughout these cases, the Obama administration, in defending the law, has had a pretty tough time laying out what's called, in legal parlance, a limiting principle. Why Congress, if they could do this, force you to purchase health insurance, couldn't also force you to purchase broccoli or General Motors cars?
Well, I'm all for the broccoli. That sounds like a good idea. Well, let's go back to those people who would choose not to send their children to school. That's inactive.
Well, it's a good point, except that comes under a different, it doesn't come up under the Commerce Clause. That comes up under a sort of, you have a right to, you know, it's under this long string of cases that has to do with privacy and family integrity and the right to raise your family as you see fit. But I think maybe driver's licenses is a better example. And just the argument is that Congress can do all sorts of, can make you do all sorts of things. They can make you wear seat belts. They can do all sorts of things because you're acting, because you're doing something.
Mm-hmm.
The argument here is if you're doing nothing, you're just sitting in your house determined to never die and never go to a hospital and never get sick, how can Congress force you, coerce you
right.
into purchasing insurance. And that really is, as I say, it was an ingenious argument because I think it leads to this parade of horribles that suggests that really fundamentally you are not free if Congress has this power.
But obviously this isn't what's really bugging people. What's really bugging people about this?
Well, I mean, I don't know what's really bugging people. I think that, you know, a lot of these 26 states' attorneys just felt that this was a good example of a law that was huge in scope, very, very ambitious, an attempt to solve a nationwide crisis, and was just seen right from the beginning as an overreach. I mean, even Democrats hate the individual mandate. So I think that it goes to this very, very deep American idea that the government shouldn't be able to tell you what to do. And I think more profoundly, and there, I think there is some real resonance here, that if the government can tell you you have to buy something, then they can make you do anything. And I think that that, as I said, has gained just enormous emotional and visceral traction in this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if they had similar kinds of concerns in Massachusetts?
Well, you know, one of the things that's so interesting about this law, the way it's come about, is that at the beginning when, you know, it was proposed in Massachusetts and when the Heritage Foundation was for it and all these conservative groups, one of the things we forget is that this is a market-based solution, right? This forces people to buy insurance from insurers. It's not single-payer. It's not the Canadian
right.
system. And that this was touted in the 90s as a conservative program and a conservative idea. It was a deeply conservative notion that we would let the market solve the problem. And also, I think, groups like the Heritage Foundation and Mitt Romney and even the first Newt Gingrich, who supported this law, in the 90s, all those conservative thinkers said that they understood the problem, the free rider problem in health insurance, which is if you don't force people to purchase insurance, all the healthy people won't purchase it. Only the sick people will purchase it when they need it, and everybody will pay for it. I mean, that's always been the argument, and that is an argument that conservatives first put forward long before the Obama administration seized on this. So I think one of the really fascinating things about this controversy over the law is that we look at it a little bit ahistorically and we forget that the origins of this idea that people would need to be pushed into the marketplace even against their will was a deeply conservative notion before they turned on it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, don't you remember? Don't you wish we all remembered our history on all these issues? But
oh,
we don't.
I wish I remembered yesterday. I think that we forget in the sweep of things where this law came from.
Right. Well, you're doing just fine. We have a ton of people who would like to speak to the issue. We will go to your phone calls. The number is 800-486-8655. The email, if you would like to use that form of communication, is talk@WPR.org. We're looking at the Supreme Court decision on Monday to hear a challenge to the 2010 health care overhaul bill, their reasons for doing so, what parts of the bill they were looking at specifically, and the fact that this is going to happen right smack dab in the middle of a presidential election. What does that do to the election in terms of, does it give an advantage to one side or the other, or advantages to both, or no advantages to anybody? We start our calls with Judy in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Judy.
Hi. I'm a 60-year-old senior who's very worried about this health care system, and I think that Canada and the European countries have the right idea. They charge a little bit more in taxes, and everyone gets free health care. I can't see, I don't think that the court should decide it. I think that I would, as a tax-paying American citizen for many years, I need this insurance, and the fact that it may be taken away from me in the future scares the heck out of me. And I think that if they took a vote, I think people would be willing to pay a little bit more for everyone to have free health care, and they wouldn't have to end up in the court system to decide it.
Well, we don't seem to be able to do that, do we, Delia?
Well, you know, one of the things that's really interesting, I think Judy makes two really important points. One is that the Obama administration had the option to try to push for single payer, the kind of system that she's describing that exists in Canada and all over Europe, where, you know, we're all universally insured and we all pay out for it. The administration made the decision not to do that. They didn't feel that they could pass it. And I think given that having passed a much more moderate, or, you know, I think probably the Obama folks would say, less socialist bill. They really thought, we can't get the other thing passed, so we'll do this more temperate thing, which is this market-based bill. And then to see it absolutely scuttled, both in the courts and, you know, by opposition throughout the Congress. I mean, you have more than one Republican candidate running for president on the promise that they will repeal this come next year. So I think it's a really interesting problem they got into. By not going whole hog and seeking single payer, they got something they thought would mollify their opponents, and their opponents hated it anyway. The only other thing that I think Judy says that's so important is that one of the things the Obama administration has hoped for very, very deeply was that after signing the bill into law, everybody thought, oh, this is a catastrophe, this is fundamentally, you know, communism, they're going to make me do something I don't want to do. And then the benefits started to kick in, and folks started to realize, oh, you know, I can have my older children on my insurance, and all sorts of other benefits of the law started to kick in. So what we've seen really interestingly is that as people have been polled about the law in the past year and a half, their opinion of it has gone up. For precisely the reason Judy states, which is, I need this, I want this. Once I realize this doesn't, you know, make me a socialist in Moscow, that there are benefits that accrue to me, they start to change their mind about this. And so I think one of the things the Obama administration was hoping is that the intervening time between when the law was signed into law and the legal challenges were filed, and here we are, you know, down the road, and we'll be even further down the road in March, that public opinion would shift as people started to realize, hey, particularly in a really tough economy, this bill gives me a lot more health insurance than I would have had otherwise.
And if that's the case, why didn't the really big benefits of the bill kick in now instead of a couple of years hence?
Well, I think that the provisions that kick in, I mean, one of the really interesting things is that, and we should talk about this because it's part of the big appeal, but the individual mandate kicks in 2014. Mm-hmm. So that part doesn't even kick in until 2014, and that raises this whole other issue that the court has agreed to hear. It's a fascinating problem. There's something called the Anti-Injunction Act, which is a 19th century law that says that nobody has standing. You can't even walk into a court and talk to a judge to object to a tax unless you've paid the tax and already had it collected. And so that's one of the four issues the court has agreed to hear in this case. And they haven't. What's really interesting and important for your listeners, this wasn't an issue in the 11th Circuit appeal that they took. So they reached out and they said, we want extra briefing on this. We want extra argument on this issue of, is it possible that we don't even have jurisdiction to hear this case? And it's important because of what you just said. It's a way for the court, if they decide to go that way, and this is the route that the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals took. It's also, and this is interesting, the route that one of the judges in the appeals court, the D.C. appeals court, one of the most conservative judges in America, Brett Kavanaugh, a George W. Bush appointee, who said last week in an opinion, this is a way for the court to kick this can down the road until 2015. Wink, wink. Think about it, court. Think about not deciding this right now. And so when you have one of the most well-respected, very conservative jurists saying to the court, there's an exit here, you don't have to take this, that's a signal that conservatives on the court might be receptive to that argument.
More phone calls in just a moment. Dahlia Lithwick is our guest, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate. She writes the column Supreme Court Dispatches, and we'll take more phone calls momentarily at 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, we're going to talk with two people in a terrific show at the Milwaukee Rep Stackner Cabaret. It's Songman Dance Man. John Peterson is the playwright, performer, marvelous tap dancer and singer who's taken the stories and the music of George M. Cohan, Fred Astaire, Bobby Darin, Sammy Davis Jr., Gene Kelly, Anthony Newley, and Donald O'Connor and put their stories and music on stage. And Jack Forbes Wilson is the pianist for this show. You may remember Jack from his great Liberace performance last season. So we'll hear some of the music and talk about being a one-man show. Hour two. To you, more of your phone calls, Scott in La Crosse. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Kathleen.
Hi.
Excellent program, excellent guest. One of the many things that I forgot to do during my long and checkered life is to go to law school, so I'm sure there's a subtlety I'm missing here, but could you explain to me, if you were, let's say, a draft-age male living in the 1960s and wanted to do no more than sit safely home, and suddenly the government came along and said, I want you to join the U.S. Army and carry a rifle in Vietnam. Doesn't that kind of defy this inactivity argument?
It's a great question, Scott. I mean, two things. One, remember that this watershed revolution of when the court started to really broadly define the Commerce Clause to allow Congress to do pretty much anything it wanted to do started in the 1940s. So by the 60s, already there were at the height, really the zenith of congressional power to call anything it wants interstate commerce. But you're quite right about the activity-inactivity point, and I didn't catch this in law school, and I remembered to go to law school, but one of the things that defenders of the law say in response to this inactivity-activity point is a much more acute example than the one you just gave. There was, at some point in the 18th century, I believe, and I don't have it in front of me, something called a Militia Act, which forced people not only to be in a militia, it actually forced them to buy weapons and certain kinds of ammunition for their weapons. And so their response when they hear opponents of the ACA say, wait, you know, this is forcing us to buy something and otherwise we would be passive, they point to the Militia Act, and it's such, I'm feeling like either Jon Stewart or Stephen Colbert tangled with someone a few weeks ago who busted out the Militia Act, and that was the end of it. But I really do think it's even a more extreme example of being forced to participate in the military. They were actually forced to purchase ammunition and rifles. And so the argument is, as long ago as then, this distinction between activity and inactivity was false, and that you were forced to purchase things even in the early Congresses, so you cannot make the argument that this is the first unprecedented time that Americans are being forced to purchase anything.
Well, now you know you have the mind of a potentially fine lawyer, Scott.
Yeah, right. That would have done me a lot more good about three or four decades ago. Anyhow, thanks so much.
Thanks for the call. An email that's come in from Bill in Madison. Do we know enough about the health care case and the judges, their past decisions, et cetera, to be able to predict with reasonable confidence the outcome of all of this?
Wow. So, Bill, I wish I'd gone to gambling school because that really is the question. I think if the bookies are making odds on this, what they have to do is go back and read all nine of the Supreme Court sitting justices and try to figure out really where their head is on this fundamental central question of what constitutes interstate commerce, what does the Commerce Clause allow, do we accept this distinction between activity and inactivity? Here's what we don't know. The two newest justices on the conservative wing of the court, that would be Chief Justice John Roberts and Samuel Alito, haven't done much on this area. We don't have a lot of writing of theirs to plumb on these questions, and so I think it's fair to say we don't exactly know what they're going to do. We know they're both, you know, very conservative. And in fact, I think we could say they're movement conservatives. That is to say, you know, Federalist Society, you know, they came up after the Mises Revolution, and they certainly came up with a healthy suspicion of government overreach and a state's rights bent. But we don't know enough to really say. The person who almost certainly will vote to strike this down is Clarence Thomas, for two reasons. One is this is all And there's a really good, if you read nothing else about this, Jeff Toobin did a great piece in The New Yorker talking about Clarence Thomas and his view of the Health Care Act. Remember that his wife, Ginny Thomas, was the head of a lobby organization that one of their goals was to strike this thing down. So I don't think there's any doubt where Clarence Thomas is, but also, and this is important, Clarence Thomas is the only sitting justice on the current Supreme Court who doesn't believe in stare decisis, which means he simply doesn't believe that that 1942 case or all the cases that came after it have any value. His feeling is, if the court's got it wrong, we strike it down. And so I think it's very fair to say that he won't feel bound by decades of constitutional history.
Dave in Appleton, hi.
Hi. Well, another lawyer talk here, I suppose. But Social Security, Medicare fall under the same thing as health care in this situation. You have to do it. You may not use it. So if the court takes the philosophical bent that they seem to be taking, philosophy uber alles, then goodbye to Social Security, Medicare, and then if they even take it reducto ad absurdum, would be that if someone didn't pay for health care, then they shouldn't get the health care benefit. So let them die on the hospital steps or the church steps or wherever they choose to die if they don't have health care because they haven't paid in. So I hope to God this country isn't going in the direction of philosophers who will destroy this country because they have some sort of rigid ideology behind it.
Dahlia.
I'm so glad you called because we've talked about the three other huge issues the court is going to hear argument on, and you've just mentioned the fourth, which is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. And I just want to briefly explain. So the first three issues are just to review. Is the individual mandate constitutional? Is it severable, which is to say if the court strikes down the individual mandate, does the entire law fall? This third question we just talked about, the Tax Injunction Act, which means is this case even appropriately before a court, or do we have to wait till 2015? And you've just pointed out the fourth, and this is the big surprise. This is the thing that I wrote about on Monday. The court reached out to an issue that no court has upheld, and that is the part of this law that is a Medicaid expansion that would put a lot more people on the Medicaid rolls, and no court has said that's unconstitutional. Even the court that struck down the individual mandate didn't have a problem with the Medicaid expansion, but this court asked for extra briefing on that, an extra argument, and so that looks a little bit like a smoke signal from the court, that it's willing to go very much farther than simply addressing this Commerce Clause issue and get into precisely the issues you're describing, what's called the Spending Clause and Congress's power to use its money to coerce the states to do things, and all of the programs you're talking about are examples of that. So one of the things, and I know this is super, super, super inside baseball, but it's something to watch for, and it's something we haven't talked about very much, is in agreeing to hear that issue, an issue that everyone thought was a non-starter and has been a non-starter in all of the lower courts who've heard it, is the court willing to go even further than this scrutiny of the Commerce Clause and start to look at these state-federal partnerships and whether the states are being coerced by federal programs? And I quite agree with you, and I would say if you feel strongly about this, go back and read the piece we did on Slate about it on Monday, but I quite agree with you that it's not just health care that falls. It's pretty much every program, including, you know, Title VII and other programs where there are these federal state funding deals that could fall as well.
Hmm. And do you think that states are expressing, many of them, this thought that they're being coerced just because the economies of many states are in the tubes?
Well, that's a part of it, and it's part of the just general sensibility that we're hearing right now of states' rights and the 10th Amendment and, you know, the government, the federal government can't boss the states around. So it's certainly of a piece with that, but I think it's fair to say this notion that the federal money that is conditioned on state compliance has, and that it is coercive, this argument has been around for some time now. As I said, I think it was really seen as a very, very fringe argument, which is why the court watchers were, I think, almost universally surprised when the court asked for briefing and argument on this issue. It feels like such a fringe legal view that there was some real concern about why the court agreed to hear it.
And why do you think they did?
Well, you know, I think they agreed to hear it because 26 state attorneys general saw fit to make the argument.
I see.
And there was some piece of this that is simply respect and deference to the argument. But given that the lower courts didn't countenance this as a serious argument and the appeals courts didn't, I think there's also a little signaling going on here that the court is open to arguments of that sort, the kinds of arguments that haven't really been made before.
Thank you, Dave, for your call. We go to Janice in La Crosse. Hi, Janice.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen.
Hi.
And just a great program. Thank you. And your guest is very, obviously very qualified to answer these questions. But for me, Kathleen, this is just a very moral issue for me, actually, as far as Obamacare and being Catholic. I do not want to pay for contraceptives or be forced to be paying for contraceptives. And the issue is still about Planned Parenthood and money, you know, to be going for abortions. That's just like a huge thing for me.
Dahlia?
I mean, I think, you know, it's a whole other issue. Obamacare, as you may recall, was almost scuttled over this, and at the very last minute, President Obama went out of his way to fudge this legislation so that people who had these conscientious objections to paying for contraception or abortion wouldn't be paying for it. So that's out of the law, and much to the chagrin, by the way, of the pro-choice movement. But I think that the important thing here is there is a Hyde Amendment. The Hyde Amendment provides and has provided for a long time that taxpayer funds cannot be used to finance abortion. The Hyde Amendment is built into this law, and it is simply not the case that Obamacare is a mechanism to finance abortions. We have law in this country that prohibits that. It's called the Hyde Amendment, and this did nothing to undermine the Hyde Amendment.
Thanks, Janice. Here's an email from Paul. What about the so-called Good Samaritan laws requiring a person to take action? Although I don't believe we have any at the federal level, I may be wrong. We certainly have a societal expectation, and I believe that the courts also indirectly support the Good Samaritan principle by penalizing those who don't demonstrate it. Can the demands that caring for the uninsured cause be seen as anything less than an influence on interstate commerce, not to mention the treatment regimens not entirely frequently cross state lines?
Huh, it's a really good question. Now, my recollection is different. I seem to remember from tort law that we actually have very few Good Samaritan laws in this country, and that goes exactly to this point of what is freedom. You know, Americans actually don't, in many instances, have a legal duty to rescue. We're pretty much a country where we say, you know, if somebody is drowning, you don't have the duty to wave in and save them. Once, by the way, you start, I should just, as to be clear, once you start to rescue someone, you have an obligation to try to fulfill it. But I think that the Good Samaritan law actually cuts the other way in this case, because there is a very deeply, I think, American legal sensibility that says, I'm not my brother's keeper, and I don't have to pay for someone else to have medical care. But I think the deeper argument that the Obama administration has tried to advance, and certainly I've seen them argue this in the court cases, is it has nothing to do with your duty to rescue other people. It has to do with the reality that even though you may say, you know, if my kidney ever pops out, by gosh, I will sew it back myself. You know, I will live here in my mountaintop cabin and never require medical intervention. The day always comes when you do.
Mm-hmm.
And the hospitals have a duty to treat you if you show up, even without health insurance. And so we have created this absolutely bankrupting system whereby people do not have insurance. They believe themselves to be immune to accidents. And quite right, the email is quite right, you're across state lines, you're visiting New Hampshire, you're visiting Florida, and you get into a car wreck and you don't have insurance, everyone else pays. And so I think the argument is, in effect, the system is predicated on this false belief that we all have, that we're the one guy who never gets in a car wreck. And if everyone believes that, the system collapses. And I should just add that that's a really interesting Escher staircase built into this law, because the Obama administration has taken the position from the beginning that without the individual mandate, without the forced purchase of And I shouldn't say forced. You're just penalized if you don't. But without purchasing health insurance, the entire law can't work. The entire law, they say, is predicated on this idea that everybody's in the pool. And so the Obama administration is now in this sort of paradoxical situation where, having argued that, they have to now deal with the severability question. The
right.
severability question says, if we strike down the mandate, does the rest of the law stand? The Obama administration has to both argue both sides of this. They have to say, well, we've been saying all along the law doesn't work without the individual mandate, but at the same time, they're going to go into court now and argue, but even if you strike down the individual mandate, please preserve the law. And that's just a paradox that they've had
right.
to live with.
Yeah. Let's just talk politics for a few moments here, Dahlia. I have a hard time understanding when you use that phrase, bankrupting system. People have been talking about how people are being bankrupted, businesses are, due to health care costs, for years and years and years and years now. And Democrats and Republicans seem to have agreed on certain parts of the healthcare system that simply must be changed. Then you get some change in a system, which public option people are saying, you know, was not nearly far enough. And yet you've got this huge hoopla about the possible changes that are incorporated in this bill that those supporters say more people will be covered. When the heck are we going to deal with a bankrupting system here? It's just incredible how long this debate goes on and how nothing is going to satisfy everybody. And so we still have skyrocketing health costs, a lot of people without insurance, businesses not being able to pay the upcoming premiums, the ones that keep going up. It just continues to be a divisive mess.
I share your frustration. I think one of the things that's so paradoxical about this system, as I said before, is this was Mitt Romney's system. This was not a socialist, liberal, you know,
right.
Attempt to make everybody obey. This was a system that was absolutely based on the idea that the market fixes everything. And so it seems to me that conservative critics of this law, and this is why Mitt Romney has tried so hard to say, well, you know, yes, I supported it when I did it, but I don't support it when the president does it. And it's fundamentally the same program.
Right.
So I think this is just, as you say, politics. I think that it's been messaged extremely well, all the stuff you and I talked about at the very beginning, as an encroachment on freedom and as a violation of people's right to live as they want. And because of that, it's distracted from exactly the issues that you and I, you know, are struggling to pay our health insurance and all the people who can't afford health insurance or have pre-existing conditions and can't even get a policy. Those people have been kind of co-opted into this very, very, I think, side debate about what is freedom and are they going to make us eat broccoli? And this was, you know, Obama's gamble. I mean, he pushed this thing through. He knew it wasn't popular. He was elected on the promise that he would solve this problem. I think he felt a moral obligation to solve it. But it is quite true that instead of talking about solving the problem, we're going to end up in the Supreme Court this June with a very, very partisan, probably angry decision that has nothing to do with fixing the system.
Right, right. Nothing to do with it. It's just incredible. Jim in Madison, hi.
Hi. I have a quick question for the guest. First, I want to compliment her on not using those meaningless terms of liberal and conservative, because I think it muddies the issue. But my question goes to the spending clause, and if you just go back to that, doesn't that strike at the heart of federalism? And isn't this then a fight? Of course, we fought a civil war over that issue, and doesn't this distill down to a fight over federal jurisdiction versus state's jurisdiction, so that Massachusetts is okay to have a health reform program. It's not okay if it's a federal program. Isn't that a states' rights versus federalism issue?
I think you're exactly right, and I think you make such an important point. One of the reasons that states could impose precisely what the ACA does on a national level is that states have enormous, it's called police powers. States have huge rights to tell their citizens what to do, vastly more rights than the federal government has to tell their citizens what to do. And so one argument you could make in this case is states can make you eat broccoli, arguably, but the federal government can't. And so you're quite right. You know, one of the issues here really is the difference between what states can tell you to do and what the federal government can tell you to do. But again, I think it's just so important to get back to Wickard versus Filburn in 1942 and the argument that we no longer have an economy that we had in the time that the framers contemplated the economy. States really were independent bubbles. You know, they really, there wasn't a lot of interstate commerce. Today, everything we do economically is an interstate decision, and at least since 1942 in Wickard versus Filburn, the court has agreed with that. Even my decision to grow wheat privately for my family has interstate economic consequences. And here's where Justice Scalia, who we didn't talk about before, really is interesting. One of the most important opinions Justice Scalia signed off on was an opinion saying that even the decision on the part of people dying in California of cancer to grow pot in their kitchen windows for their own medicinal use, even that implicates interstate commerce. And so I think you have the most conservative jurist on the court signing off on precisely the principle that it's all federal, it's all congressional power, because even my decision to grow pot for my own use affects interstate commerce. And so I think it's simply a recognition. You can say it's right or wrong, but since the 1940s, the courts have recognized that there really aren't intrastate economic questions. It's all interstate. And I think the fact that Justice Scalia himself has signed off on that legal principle, A, suggests that this fight is over, and B, suggests that Scalia's vote is much more in play in this case than people think.
Interesting. More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the Supreme Court making a decision to hear the challenge to the health care overhaul law. They will hear it in the spring, and they will make a decision right in the middle of a big presidential campaign. So joining us to discuss all of that is Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate. She writes the column Supreme Court Dispatches. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Hour two of our program this Thursday, the songs and dances of George M. Cohen, Fred Astaire, Bobby Darin, Sammy Davis Jr., Gene Kelly, Anthony Newley, and Donald O'Connor, Songman, Dance Man. It's at the Milwaukee Rep Stackner Cabaret. John Peterson, who created this show and sings and dances in it, and pianist Jack Forbes Wilson, who last season played Liberace, will be with us to talk. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Michael in Milwaukee. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. First of all, I'm a staunch dyed-in-the-wool Democrat, and I'm a strong supporter of the president, but I'll tell you what, I just... I think that this individual mandate is just the wrong thing. It's just in my mind, it's just not right. Whatever that means, I don't know. But whether or not they enforce the mandate, or they say that the individual mandate can't be in the bill or whatever, it's kind of a moot point, because the real problem here is this country cannot afford the health care that we think we should have. We can't provide the health care for everybody that we now provide for some. And we just can't afford it. Hard decisions have to be made somewhere across the down the line, and nobody wants to make those decisions as who gets health care or how it's divided out amongst the people.
Dahlia.
Well, two things. You know, Michael, I think, speaks to, you know, a Kaiser poll, a recent Kaiser poll shows only 52% of Democrats support the mandate. So this is not, as your prior caller said, this is not a left-right partisan issue. Democrats are having a huge problem with the individual mandate, and I think Michael gives voice to that. You know, but I think that this goes back to your question to me, Kathleen, which is everybody wants the system to be fixed. We didn't want single payer like they had in Canada. They tried to create a system that would be market-based and yet, you know, give comprehensive care in a way that we have not ever had in this country, and it's collapsed. So really the question is, we can't say we want our health insurance system fixed. We want the ballooning costs to be controlled, and also we hate this plan. You know, one of the things that I think is going to be interesting is that a lot of the folks who supported health reform have said maybe it will be a great thing if the court ultimately strikes this down in June. It certainly won't be good for Obama in an election year, but it may mean that single-payer universal health care rises from the ashes. I mean, it is entirely possible that having tried this intermediate step and failed, maybe Americans really could be persuaded to come to love the Canadian system. So that's, I mean, that's some of the frustration I think you're hearing in Michael's voice and that I'm hearing in yours. But one possible outcome of this isn't that we continue down this path of insanity. It's that we go to a path that was deemed too radical to try.
Mm. Oh, that's interesting. Mike in Franklin, hi.
Hi. You know, real quickly, I'd like to have the guest relate this to how we regulate people who refuse service, for example, if they have communicable diseases. You know, we all know the story of Typhoid Mary. That seems to need to be within the same realm here. But I also would like to just quickly react to a couple of the past callers. Is, you know, the one thing I'm hearing in the show today is it's obvious that we still have a communication problem. This health care bill was primarily, with a few exceptions and individual mandate being one of them, is primarily a health care or insurance regulation bill, if you will, and I call it that because it really doesn't call for the government paying for health care for everybody. Rather, it's saying if you're going to be providing health care, here are the things that you have to do, here's how you have to get involved, et cetera, et cetera. But it's really not, you know, that taxpayers are going to be paying for everybody's health care.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, and in fact, I think that Congressional Budget Office and other studies have shown that in the end, we will pay a lot less and that the economy will pay a lot less, that this bill is in fact going to be a net savings for the American people. But I think that goes again to this point that we had this amazing sideline argument about freedom and government coercion and, you know, being told what kind of cars to drive and food to eat, and we had that in lieu of exactly the debate Mike is talking about having, which is how do we get insurers to act responsibly? How do we create a system in which there are no free riders? We just didn't have that conversation. I actually fault the Obama administration for not selling the bill on the terms that Mike's describing.
Let's go. A number of people have talked about vaccinations. Here's an email that has come in. Please relate the commerce argument to vaccinations with its opt-out option. If we can be told to have vaccinations, can't we be told to have health care?
Well, again, I think that we have opt-out options for vaccinations.
Mm-hmm.
My sons go to schools where, you know, kind of terrifying chunks of their classes
are not
opt out of vaccines. Mm-hmm. And so I think it goes to this clash we described earlier about there is a right to family privacy and family autonomy, and you can make those fundamental health care decisions for your family. You can opt out of vaccinations. But I think, again, the issue in this case is interstate commerce. The issue in this case is a different issue from family autonomy and privacy. It's a question of whether Congress can make you buy into a system you don't want to buy into, and that in turn triggers this inquiry about is this individual activity, state activity, or interstate activity, national activity. And I think that really is the question that the court has to look at.
Dahlia, I understand that they're changing the way they normally do things. There's much more time that will be given to arguments for this.
That's right. This is going to be a modern record. You know, 5.5 hours.
Wow.
Of oral argument over 2 days, as I understand it. And we haven't seen that in a long, long time. Even Bush v. Gore and Citizens United and the blockbuster cases I've heard in my career at the court have been 2 hours max. So this is epic in scope. And I think that, you know, the other thing we didn't talk about but we should have at least flicked at is that there's been a lot of calls for various justices to recuse themselves in this case.
Mm-hmm.
Justice Thomas was asked by many members of Congress to step back because of his wife's activity in the case. There's been a burgeoning movement to try to get Elena Kagan off this case because she was President Obama's Solicitor General when the law was passed. There's been a lot of action trying to suggest that different justices are compromised for different reasons. Justices, and I just want to make the point because it's so important, had any of the nine justices felt that they were going to take themselves out of the case, we would have heard about it on Monday when cert was granted. Oh. So I think your listeners should go forward with the presumption that not only is it going to be 5.5 hours in March, it's going to be 5.5 hours with all nine jurists on the bench.
5.5 hours. Woo! Well, that's something. And finally, from John in Medford, who really thinks that this is all political. He writes, the Republicans fear the Americans will actually like this plan and the president will get credit from the people and that will kill their number one goal of trying to destroy Obama. He says it's that simple. Is it that simple?
I feel like, you know, this is what you and I have been saying for an hour and so many of your callers have been saying, that this is ultimately a completely political fight that has been mashed into the courts on this, you know, pretty slim read of we're going to do away with, you know, 60 years or 70 years of constitutional law. So, of course, it's a political fight. You know, we've heard over and over and over again, you know, Mitch McConnell's quote that, you know, our number one aim is to bring Obama down, and there is no better way to bring him down than to scuttle his signature piece of legislation. So I think it's clearly political. Whether you're for it or against it is a different question, but it seems to me that, as you and I have said, we have not discussed this initiative on the merits. We have not talked about how to solve the problem. We have instead talked about some really crazy ideas about what is freedom and what the government can coerce you to do, and that was never the point.
Dahlia, thank you so much. What an informative hour this has been. Dahlia Lithwick, our guest, senior editor and legal correspondent for Slate. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for all of your marvelous calls. Sorry we couldn't get to everybody. We'll return.